You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A reminder before we get going with Lincoln Chafee, this is our spring fundraiser, and I'd like you to think about how much you rely on WNYC for news and information, and then please make a contribution in an amount that fits your budget. And if you call right now, you will be automatically entered to win a trip to Tuscany, courtesy of Bloomsbury Auctions. You're automatically entered when you call 1-888-376-WNYC or go to WNYC.org and make a pledge. You don't have to pledge to enter, but we sure hope that you will support WNYC with a contribution. It takes just a few minutes to show your support for all of the diverse news, information, and music programs you've come to rely on from WNYC. So call now, 1-888-376-WNYC, or go to our website, WNYC.org, and make an e-pledge. Senator Lincoln Chafee is here. In 2002, he was the only Republican senator to vote against going to war in Iraq. And it wasn't the first time he went against his party's positions either, because he's also pro-choice, not opposed to gay marriage, and occasionally also thinks taxes are an appropriate option. He recounts his time in the Senate and the reasons he spoke out against the Republican leadership in his new book, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Very pleased that it brings Lincoln Chafee, who is now serving as a distinguished professor at Brown University, back to the show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard, very much. Pleasure to join you.
So why was Congress as compliant as you claim in your subtitle?
At the beginning, it was a mystery, and particularly with the big tax cut, the $1.6 trillion tax cut that the president and the vice president were touting when they first came to office in the spring of 2001, which was, of course, before September 11th, and the big, big fight.
So we can't blame this one on September 11th.
That's right. And to put it in perspective, President Clinton had vetoed a $400 billion tax cut in October of 2000 as too deep and irresponsible and jeopardizing our surpluses. Here we were just months later debating a $1.6 trillion tax cut. And so it's the Congress, when I saw Congress roll over for that.
And you voted against it?
Yes, and Senator McCain was the only other Republican to vote against it, curiously. Now he's saying make these tax cuts permanent. But
some Democrats voted
over for that, Leonard. That was the big mystery to me.
Including some Democrats? Did you wonder why the Democrats did?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of set the stage for what was to come later.
In the first chapter of your book, you describe a meeting of moderate Republicans that took place every Wednesday over lunch. Were the moderates already feeling like an endangered species?
Oh, yes. Yes, from years going by when there would be maybe 20 moderates that would meet for lunch. When I got there, it was five: Senator Specter, Senator Snow, Senator Collins, Senator Jeffords, and I. And we did loyally meet every Wednesday, have lunch, and talk about issues that we shared in common.
And Dick Cheney actually visited your group in December 2000. Why would he visit your group? He definitely wasn't a moderate Republican.
Well, Senator Specter would occasionally invite guests to join us. And he had invited our vice president, Challenger, because he hadn't been minted yet by the Supreme Court, which happened that Tuesday night before he met with us. And I thought when I heard the news that Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Bush Cheney in December of 2000, he wouldn't keep his appointment with us the next day. But he was there, and the doors closed, and all the staff and photographers and media left. And it was just the six of us, the vice president, the five moderate Republicans. And there he spelled out an agenda for the new administration, which was just hours old, that literally had me almost falling off my chair. I was thinking to myself, you didn't run on this program. You said you're going to be uniters. Here you bring in a very divisive agenda. In the campaign, Governor Bush, the candidate, said we'll have a humble foreign policy. You've just outlined a very arrogant foreign policy, getting out of Kyoto, getting out of International Criminal Court and the like. And my fellow moderates didn't push back and say, it's a 50-50 Senate, you're going to need our votes, and we don't agree with this agenda. That didn't happen. So two things really surprised me. Number one, the vice president had the gall to lay this out, not the president. And then my fellow moderates weren't taking exception to this agenda right off the bat.
Well, Harry Reid was here not long ago, and he's written a book in which he says that senators like Specter give him the vote only when it's not needed. But when on all the important votes, they vote with the party. And I suspect that's because they are afraid of being seen as disloyal or afraid of losing the primaries where they are much more vulnerable. And Spector has been under attack in various primaries.
Yes, he won his last primary by, I think, 1%, one percentage point.
So,
that's only a fear. I had a primary in my election in 2006, but I won that fairly handily.
So were you pleased that the Supreme Court had voted that way as a loyal Republican?
At the time, I was. At the time, I was. I was a supporter of Governor Bush, and especially because he was saying, I'm a uniter, not a divider, and I'd served for a year under President Clinton in that toxic atmosphere of fighting and partisanship. And also, I cheered when Jim Lehrer asked him in the debate, what kind of foreign policy will you have? And here we were, sole superpower status, you might say, United States. And he said, we'll have a humble foreign policy. And I was cheering in my living room watching.
So when Vice President Cheney said these things, did you think, I know you said you were surprised, but did you get the impression that this was their intention all along and they had just simply been presenting themselves differently? Or had the victory emboldened the Cheney part of the White House?
I was on my guard, certainly, after hearing that. I was literally shaken up, I will say. Went back to my chief of staff and said, we've got to write a letter to the vice president-elect. And we did that right away. I wrote a letter to him right away saying, I don't agree with what you just told us at this lunch. But I was hoping the president would take a different view. And when they had the Vice President Gore presided over the counting of the electoral votes and the Black Caucus was shouting out, one senator object, and none of us did, Democrat or Republican, because we were hoping it would be different, despite what I'd heard at that lunch.
Haven't you always challenged expectations? What made you decide to become a blacksmith right after you studied classics at Brown?
I was working construction during the summers as a laborer, and I enjoyed the work, getting a paycheck on Friday, but I didn't like being a laborer. And so I was looking for a way to get a trade, be a bricklayer, a welder, one of the trades. And I'd grown up with a horse, and I'd seen the Horseshoe of Shulam, and I saw a school, horseshoeing school, went to it, and then worked for a blacksmith and got on the harness racing tracks and enjoyed it. Did it for about 7 years. I still shoe my horse, so.
But you come from
might go back to it someday.
You come from a really political family, and I'm assuming that you were expected to join the family business.
I wouldn't say that. My dad always told prospective politicians, make sure you have something to fall back on.
Because blacksmithing?
Whatever it is, a lawyer, blacksmithing, have something to fall back on. Because if you want to have the confidence to do what you think is right, even if the voters might vote you out.
So what made you decide to come back after 7 years and enter politics?
I was working on the harness track circuit in Calgary and Edmonton, and I just ended up out there. I didn't know a soul on the racetrack. I did it for 7 years. The winters are long out there in Alberta, and I thought I'd come back, maybe get on the New York tracks at the time Roosevelt was open, Yonkers, or Foxborough outside of Boston. But once I got back here, I started to think maybe I'll try something different. I got a different job, and then I ran for a local office, a very, very obscure local office. That was my first, and I won that. Then I got on the city council in my city, became mayor, and then into the U.S. Senate.
How influential was your father on your political ideology?
Oh, very influential. Just growing up, he'd been a moderate governor. There was a group of moderate Republican governors in the 60s, Mark Hatfield, Chuck Percy, John Volpe, certainly Nelson Rockefeller here in New York. There was a big bond of moderate Republican governors that I thought would direct the party, and that was my philosophy, certainly.
Fiscal conservatism,
care about the environment, fear of foreign entanglements, use the tools of government to help the less fortunate. Those are my cornerstones of philosophy.
My guest is Senator Lincoln Chafee. He's written a book called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. Many of your views are rather liberal for today's Republican Party, but as you suggested, they would have been considered perfectly fine during when it was called the Eisenhower wing and then later the Rockefeller wing of the party. So the current Republican Party is very different from the one that your father was a member of?
Absolutely. And the big factor, of course, is the switch of the South from conservative Democrats, very, very conservative Democrats, now to almost solidly Republican, still very conservative. But in the 2004 elections, which Bush-Cheney were reelected, there were five open seats in the South. John Edwards was running for vice president. Fritz Hollings in South Carolina was retiring. Zell Miller was still a Democrat, retiring in Georgia. Bob Graham in Florida was retiring. John Breaux in Louisiana. Five retiring Democrats in the South. Republicans swept them all. And that was the final change. And that they control our agenda in the Republican Party, the Southerners.
And most of those Democrats were very conservative Democrats.
Yes, yes. Remember those old conservative chairmen of the committees? And now they're all Republicans. Very significant what happened in Mississippi, though, in that last congressional election, the last few days.
Although it was a very conservative Democrat again, but
yeah.
Maybe that's what it takes to win in Mississippi. But it does look like it's more than just a slap in the wrist at the White House.
Yes. So even this agenda is starting to backfire, even in Mississippi, the Republican agenda.
Because they were trying to tie those candidates to Barack Obama and to Nancy Pelosi.
Yes, it didn't work.
You were the only Republican senator to have opposed banning same-sex marriage. You are a supporter of abortion rights. Did you ever consider switching parties? Or were you ever targeted by the Republican Party for voting against so many of the strongest, the kinds of things that the party has done so well with?
Well, I did consider it in the spring of 2001, certainly, because the president had gone back on his campaign promises to be a united, not a divider. I mean, his first act was an abortion act, and no matter how you feel about abortion, you can't argue that it's not divisive in this country. That was his first official act after taking the oath of office. And then the humble foreign policy, being so arrogant, going back on those two promises, made me consider my affiliation. Then Jeffords did leave the party.
And became an independent.
And became an independent caucus with the Democrats. And that threw the majority to the Democrats. So that act had occurred. But that oftentimes the parties are approaching candidates. Ben Nelson, the Republicans probably approach Ben Nelson in Nebraska or John Breaux when he was in the Senate from Louisiana and talk about switching. So that goes on all the time.
In fact, Harry Reid claims that John McCain was seriously thinking of switching to the Democrats at one point. He's denying it.
Yes, those conversations do occur on likely suspects. And John McCain certainly was a likely suspect in the spring of 2001. He and I were the only two to vote against the tax cuts. Of course, he's gone back on that now, mysteriously.
Well, he now is courting a different part of the Republican Party, going back on any number of things. Do you think he's done it because it's the only way he sees for him to win, or do you think he's had a change of heart?
I think the former, that he's just still looking at it politically, which is unfortunate from my perspective. And I'm also surprised that once locking up the nomination, he hasn't tacked to the middle more. He's still kowtowing to that right-wing base.
Considering the fact that he was seriously considered as John Kerry's running mate in 2004, he's come a long way. You say September 11th changed the distribution of power within Congress because now the fear became a big factor and it motivated people to vote in certain ways?
Yes, and after the vote of September 11th, Jeffords already left the party, so the Democrats were in control of the Senate. Tom Daschle was majority leader. Then we had the vote on the Iraq War in October of 2002. Tom Daschle was the majority leader. But the Republicans got back in the majority in that November of 2002, beating Cleland, the triple amputee, Max Cleland, Senator Cleland from Georgia.
Saying that he said he was unpatriotic.
And, yes, and Gene Carnahan. So those were the fear elections, 2002 and 2004, when red alerts and orange alerts seemed to be happening whenever the Republicans needed a boost.
Well, then, why didn't you switch at that point? You could have thrown the majority the other direction again.
No, the margin was more than one. Whereas when Jeffords left, one person crossing the aisle switched the majority. The Republicans had enough seats after 2002. I think it was 52-48. One person wouldn't have changed the majority, and that's the most common question I get. Why didn't you switch parties if you so vehemently disagreed with the agenda? And there were important bills for Rhode Island. The Republicans controlled the White House. Republicans controlled the Senate. Republicans controlled the House. I had to look after my state. There would have been retribution if I had left the party. We wouldn't have gotten highway money. We wouldn't have done well in the military base realignment and closure bill. I mean, that's just a fact of life. And that would also have hurt me politically. If you switch parties and cost your state jobs and federal money, that's a perfect 30-second spot, as we call it.
Mm. But then we did the logical thing, went to war in Afghanistan. Were you in support of that?
Yes, but I'll be honest, I had my doubts as the Twin Towers came down on a Tuesday. I had my doubts about the ability of this president and vice president to handle this traumatic act wisely. And the truth is, Leonard, when they called the roll for Afghanistan, this is on, I believe it was a Thursday, September 11th was a Tuesday, we voted to give the president authorization to respond a couple of days later. I voted no initially, and I just was concerned that this president would handle, as I said, this traumatic act wisely. I voted no, but my staff, I'm a C, a Chafee in the alphabet, for the time they finished the roll call, my staff had come over and grabbed me by the lapels and said, you can't vote against giving the president authorization. But I was originally a no, and there was only one member of Congress to vote no on Afghanistan. And that was Barbara Lee, African-American from Oakland. Out of 535 members of Congress, 100 senators, 435 members of the House, only one voted no on Afghanistan, Barbara Lee. I almost did.
Didn't she pay a price for that?
She sure did. She was death threats and had to have Capitol Police protection. So after that, I said, phew, that could have been me.
Lincoln Chafee served in the United States Senate as the Republican senator from Rhode Island from 1999 to 2007. These days, he's working as a distinguished visiting fellow at Brown University. He has written a book called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, published by St. Martin's Press in the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And we will continue our conversation, get to Iraq and other things after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Senator Lincoln Chafee, who's written a book called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And I have to tell you, Senator Chafee, that's the sort of title that I would have expected from a Democrat. In fact, a rather partisan Democrat. So have you been totally disillusioned?
Well, that when somebody breaks their word, that's important to me. And when Governor Bush, the candidate, as I said earlier in the show, was running as a United on a Divider and then went back on it right from the first minute of the first day, and also the humble foreign policy that he was going to regulate carbon dioxide, and then later that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. These are, you can't argue, these are prevarications, and that weighs heavily on me.
Although
as our national leader, we're losing our credibility around the world.
He wasn't the first president to compare Saddam Hussein to Hitler, although at the time it sounded like just slightly a bit of hyperbole to me. What was happening in Congress? Because there's a film, Phil Donahue has done a film in which he has shown a lot of the people in Congress repeating the same lines, the mushroom cloud, the Saddam is Hitler, smoking gun, weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. And it sounds like everybody just signed on.
Well, I've heard that line that everybody signed on. But don't forget there were 23 of us that voted no in the U.S. Senate, which is far too few. But it was similar to the tax cut where in the beginning, as I said earlier in the show, President Clinton vetoed a $400 billion is too deep in October when we had the tax cut. In the beginning, so many senators were saying, this is too big, $1.6 trillion is too big. We can't vote for this. And one by one, they were picked off and brought in and signed on. And that happened with the war in Iraq. In the beginning, it was Afghanistan. And when the president and vice president were talking about Saddam Hussein, people in the Senate were saying, oh, no, there's no connection. But one by one, they were brought into line, either taken down to the Oval Office or for a ride in Air Force One or who knows what, and brought in line. But there were 23
of us. And the press as well, by the way. We can point out that for a while there was a real feeling that the press was cheerleading the possibility of war.
Well, there was an air of fear and anger, and that's a bad combination. I would like to highlight a couple of the heroes, though. Robert C. Byrd was in full cry. Paul Wellstone was up in a tight election just weeks later in Minnesota. He voted no. He was willing to say no and then go face his voters in Minnesota and explain why he voted no. There were some heroes.
But you do say the conflict in Iraq is an old kind of war. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not being waged with submarines and battleships. It's being waged in guerrilla activity. And
I mean, like the American Revolution.
Yes, and suicide bombers picking off a couple of soldiers here, IEDs picking off another couple soldiers there. It's another war of attrition that is so tragic.
You write that one opponent of the war noted that the Democrats were worried that the war might be over too fast. They were afraid that this would be too much of a victory for President Bush?
That was certainly a factor, especially after so many of them had opposed the first President Bush's Gulf War in the early 90s. And I know that was a factor in many Democrats' thinking.
And a majority of Democrats voted to give the president the power to go to war. Is Hillary Clinton's vote one of the reasons you've come out in support of Barack Obama?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's unconscionable that a woman that is as smart as she is and a good lawyer couldn't see the false premise of this war. I mean, on a legal basis, if you're a lawyer just looking at it, the evidence that's presented, it wasn't compelling at all. It's unconscionable to me.
You visited Iraq in 2003 and then back in 2004.
Correct.
Did you see a lot of changes over that period?
Yes, and particularly in the first visit, we went to Afghanistan in 2003 and then into Baghdad. And what a difference. Afghanistan was the forgotten front. There was just no doubt about it. Such a minor U.S. presence, or more NATO troops there in Kabul. And then into Baghdad, where, holy smokes, there's troops everywhere, there's activity everywhere. I'm thinking to myself, what happened to Afghanistan on that first visit? And I was surprised on the first visit, which was October of 2003, so about 6 months into the war. It was going better than I thought. I mean, we were able to travel fairly freely about, and we went to Mosul and Baghdad. But a year later, it was different. We couldn't go visit the same neighborhoods we visited in 2003 when I went back a year later in 2004.
And despite the surge, the situation doesn't seem to have improved all that much recently. It's a very dangerous place to be. Were you able to ask members of the administration how they had gotten us into that kind of mess? Were you not on the right committees, were you?
Well, it's on Foreign Relations Committee, and one of the chapters in my book is about at the moment of mission accomplished, when there was a euphoria surrounding our initial exercise of going into Baghdad so quickly and statues coming down. We had a Foreign Relations Committee hearing with Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary of Defense in the Pentagon. And he was very honest. I asked him, a fair question. I said, we've thrown a rock into the pool that is the Middle East. What are the ripples that are going to go out from this rock we've thrown in? And he described in a very lucid and compelling way what we were going to do there. And one of them was peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. That was the first words out of his mouth.
He ripples predicted dual victories.
Dual victories. That this was going to be an important part by removing the threat of Saddam Hussein, that this was going to help with the peace process. And that never happened. I feel that Secretary Wolfowitz felt that it was important, but I don't think the president and vice president shared the importance. I think he was undermined in thinking that this was important.
You include that testimony by Paul Wolfowitz in the book in its entirety. So is the president are the president and vice president completely to blame for the failures in Iraq and in the Israeli peace process?
Absolutely. It's their war. And they've missed opportunity after opportunity to make it better. Certainly General Shinseki testified we'd need more troops, and they quickly retired him. And then in the Arab-Israeli peace process, there were opportunities after opportunities. Abu Mazen was elected with 60% of the vote by the Palestinian people on a platform of peace, and we did nothing to empower him. And then, of course, Hamas gets elected because we did nothing, missed opportunity after Yasser Arafat died. And it's all rhetoric and no action, and very, very sad.
Were you surprised when John McCain, who called for talking to Hamas at that time because they had won the election, recently was critical of Barack Obama because he's talked about talking to the Iranians and to some of the other people who are now seen as enemies of America?
It is two John McCains. I mean, there was the John McCain I served with in the Senate that...
Your friend.
Yes, and voted, had great voting record on the environment, was consistently voting against drilling in the Arctic Refuge, and as I said, the only other Republican, me and him, to vote against the original $1.6 trillion tax cut in the spring of 2001, and willing to meet with world leaders, the democratically elected leaders, no matter what their stripe. We have the feeling of strength that we're a strong country and we can afford to do that. And now a different John McCain that's saying we have to make the tax cuts permanent. You don't hear him saying the same environmental, touting the same environmental record, and castigating Senator Obama for some of his comments about meeting with democratically elected leaders.
You're talking about the environment, you've called one of your chapters the Party of Old King Coal, C-O-A-L. Do you have any idea why the Bush administration reneged on its election promise in 2000 to require all power plants to meet clean air standards?
I'm sure it's the coal industry is a big part of the base of the Republican, if you talk about the base. Kowtowing to the coal lobby is a big part of why the president, although he said it again, he said it as a candidate, Governor Bush, the candidate, said would include carbon dioxide as one of the fourth pollutant, the other three being nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and mercury. He said as a candidate we're going to have have carbon dioxide as the fourth pollutant, but then went back on that by March of his first term. By March, he'd reneged on that pledge. I'm sure coal is a big reason.
What was your reaction to some of the appointees who have been so divisive over the years, John Bolton being one, and a number of people to the Supreme Court, but also even people to other agencies, some of whom have been held up for years now?
I would like to say that I know we have a lot of coal in the United States, so I want to just be sure that, and a lot of people work in the coal industry, but I think it's important that we recognize it, that it pollutes and that the coal industry would be better served by developing new technology to make it cleaner, that other countries are going to develop that technology. We should be doing it, and we could still burn coal and fuel our power plants if we just burn it cleanly and develop that technology.
I think both Hillary and Barack have proposed something along those lines.
Absolutely.
In the case of Barack Obama, he's from a coal state, Illinois,
yes.
So he has
yes.
good reason to.
Yes. And then as to your question, is and the president nominating these polarizing figures such as John Bolton, it's almost he relished the conflict. I'm going to nominate John Bolton to be our ambassador to the United Nations. And he said, it was almost as serving up to the liberals, right in your face.
Finger in your eye.
The united, not a divider, was the opposite. He relished the conflict.
Well, you write that you wish someone would oppose President Bush in the Republican primary, and you even considered doing it yourself. But wouldn't that have been political suicide for any Republican?
To take on an incumbent, it does happen.
Well, we have Ron Paul now, but...
And Ted Kennedy took on Jimmy Carter. It does happen. I thought we should have a debate about where the Republican Party's going, and rather than just step back and have me stand on the sidelines and watch it change, let me make a fighting case for where this Republican Party should be going. On the other side, you don't want to be a laughing stock, you know, to be a really, really fringe candidate. So I had to weigh those two things.
After
being a first termer, going on to take on an incumbent president, first term senator, bordered on frivolous. But I did consider it.
Well, after the 2004 election, President Bush said, "I've earned political capital and I intend to spend it." So did you see him even more emboldened?
Absolutely. And I was up in 2006 when he said that. He'd just been reelected, and I knew I was up in 2 years. We call it in cycle. And I go, oh, my gosh, here comes the agenda, more right-wing agenda. And it did, privatizing Social Security, John Bolton to the United Nations, the Supreme Court fight over Sandra Day O'Connor's retiring seat. It just didn't stop.
Then you had problems fundraising for the election in 2006, despite the fact that you had very high approval ratings in your state.
Yes, it was very different from 2000 when there were my kind of Republicans still around, cared about the environment, fiscally conservative, I like to say, cared about not getting involved in overseas quagmires. This is my kind of republicanism. And personal liberties, standing up for personal liberties. But they were gone in 2006. I couldn't raise. It was so difficult in 2006. Those times the Republicans were saying, I gave to you in 2000, but not this time.
But I'm sure some Democrats might have wanted to support you. Although I wonder about changes. For example, you sound so energized right now, and you're talking very freely about things. Were you able to talk this freely at that time?
Absolutely not. No. When I was coming into politics as a Republican in a heavily Democratic state of Rhode Island, it was fun being a partisan against the other party. I mean, that's what you're supposed to be. And as a local politician, a councilman, and then mayor, that's the way the system's supposed to work. But you're not supposed to take on your own party. And that was no fun. So there was something liberating about being able to disaffiliate.
Well, there was pressure for you to leave the Republican Party in 2004. And then you got a phone call from then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And he convinced you to stay?
Yes. That's a true
story. What did
he
tell you?
That's true. I was considering my options after watching Bush Cheney win Ohio in November of 2004 and being reelected. And I knew I was up in 2006, and I knew that would be very difficult to run as a Republican. But I also knew these big bills were coming up, the highway bill and the base realignment and closure bill, very, very important to Rhode Island, billions of dollars in highway money distributed every 6 years. So it was really a no-win situation. But nonetheless, I was evaluating my options, and I got a phone call right after the election from Senator McConnell. And he said, I know what you must be thinking. He was reading my mind. And he said, we'll help you with the highway bill. We want you to stay a Republican. We like your voice in the caucus. It's different, and we like that. And we'll get behind you in the reelection. And I didn't get any calls from any Democrats, which it surprised me. I thought the Republicans had just gained even more seats, and I thought they wouldn't care about me. I'd be marginalized. And the opposite, I got that phone call. I thought they'd be popping champagne and celebrating, but big new margin in the Senate. No, they were reaching out to wayward Republicans, and Democrats weren't calling.
Well, there are comedians who talk about the Democrats having a real advantage because of the president's low approval ratings, because of all sorts of other problems. But then they say, but the Democrats will figure out a way to screw it all up.
What was Will Rogers' quote? I belong to the biggest disorganized party. I'm a Democrat or something. Will Rogers has a great quote on that.
Was that your sense as a member of the Republican Party? Because Republicans did generally seem to be able to stay on their themes, to say the things that were expected, whereas the Democrats were all over the place.
Yes, and that phone call from Senator McConnell is a really good example of how organized the Republican Party is and thinking ahead, and every seat is important. And they were reaching out. They were very organized at that moment in time.
My guest is Lincoln Chafee. He's written a book called Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, published by St. Martin's Press. As I said, you had high approval ratings. You won your primary handily, despite the fact that there was a challenge from the right. So why did you wind up losing the election to Sheldon Whitehouse, a man whose name seems really appropriate more for a presidential candidacy than Senator from Rhode Island?
Six seats. That's all my opponent said in the general election, Mr. Whitehouse. Six seats. We need six seats to get the Democrats into the majority and check the Bush agenda. And I heard that every hour in the campaign. We need six seats, and they got them.
And you also had problems fundraising, you said.
Yes.
So that
made
it
the primary. The primary really hurt.
You left the Republican Party that last summer. Would you have stayed if you had been reelected?
I had to make a commitment once I ran as a Republican to stay for at least a year, probably two. The fundraisers that were giving to me, some of them were Republicans, are saying, we want to keep that majority and we'll give to you. And they never asked me. There was never a quid pro quo. But there's something moral about running. Once you have to run, you have to make a certain commitment. So there was something liberating in a way about losing. Okay, the Democrats, they've taken over. Let's see what they can do to check this agenda. I get to disaffiliate and reevaluate where my political allegiance lies.
So are you saying that although your loss led to a change, the Democrats took over the Senate, in retrospect, it might have been a positive thing on some level.
Yes. I have not been happy about how the Democratic majority has conducted themselves in this new status. When I saw them voting to name the Iranian guards as terrorists by the same vote, was 77-23 or something, as the Iraq war vote, and giving President Bush and Vice President Cheney tickets to attack Iran, I said, I screamed when I read the paper in the morning. This is a Democratic majority, and caving in on warrantless wiretapping and the like, they just haven't been strong, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not exactly sure I understand how the whole thing works. There's been a lot of complaint that we don't have moderate center anymore. But it seems to me when the Democrats vote with the Republicans, in a sense, they have moved to the center, if anything, on those votes, to right of center.
Yes, maybe the definition of center has to be defined as to the left, that we need to fight what most Americans, believe that, as I said earlier, a good fiscally conservative program where we don't spend, and what we do spend, we have to have the revenue to support it, and we don't get involved in these foreign entanglements. We don't make the social issues a priority. I think that's, whether it's left or the center, I think that's where America is. And certainly caring about clean air and clean water, using the tools of government to help the less fortunate. I think that, whether it's left or center or right, it's where America is.
Are you enjoying your role as an academic, or are you itching to reenter politics?
This is a perfect position at the Watson Institute for International Studies, and there's a great new generation coming along. Very open-minded, this new generation coming along. They don't have any preconceived notions about how things should be conducted. They care about other countries, other cultures, other languages. It's a great new generation coming along. So that's been very gratifying to witness that in Providence. And who knows what lies ahead politically.
Well, there has been talk of a run for governor of Rhode Island. I don't know whether you could make a run for to regain your Senate seat. Obviously, the Republicans wouldn't be interested in you, and the Democrat is already in Congress. But if a seat opened up, would you consider that again? Do you miss it?
I have the luxury of not having to think about that. I did enjoy the issues immensely, particularly the international issues working in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And now present governor of Rhode Island is term limited, so that comes up in 2010. So as I said, I have the luxury that it's not imminent.
Just one more thing. Have you come out officially for someone in the run for president?
Yes, I watched all the candidates, many of whom I had served with. And when the Rhode Island primary came, I decided to support Senator Obama. And the reason were that he's had the best vision, the best message, but very, very importantly to me, the best run campaign. He's had no shakeups as the others have had in the hierarchy, and his fundraising has been just phenomenal. That translates into an administration, that organizational skill.
I wonder if you cancel out Joe Lieberman, who left the Democratic Party but votes with the Democratic caucus, but supporting John McCain.
Yes, people joke we should be in a baseball-like trade.
Senator Lincoln Chafee's book, Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President, is published by Thomas Dunn Books, which is an imprint of St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. I hope your listeners will contribute to WNYC.